Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 309. What are the key characteristics of complex systems? And what are practical patterns for tackling complex coding problems? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher covers an article about working on complex systems. The piece explores the distinction between complicated and complex problems. Each requires a fundamentally different approach to solve. We dig into a couple of tutorials about creating repeatable data science pipelines. One covers validating data frames and tables with the Point Blank library to build into a continuous integration workflow. The other explores how to use configuration files to build modular pipelines that avoid the pitfalls of hard-coded paths and parameters. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, three Python enhancement proposals, the difficulties with breaking up lines of text, a static site generator for Mariimo notebooks, and a static analyzer for malicious Python code. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right, so we got a few pieces of news, a couple peps, some releases, and then I got a whole bunch of data science stuff this week I'm excited to dig into. And you have your couple programming things that usually we're turning into discussions this week. Yeah, and then some projects. So you ready to dig in?
Let's do this.
All right, what do you got for news?
Lots of news to get to. Starting out with some security releases, Python 3.12.14, 3.11.16, and 3.10.21. Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
These are almost your typical security releases, with the exception of their size. There are over 30 issues addressed in all three of these releases, along with three or four more specific ones for each. The description jokingly explains that the release is timed with the solar eclipse in Europe. Not sure if they mean that's what was why they did a release, or whether that was the cause. I'm not sure. We'll go from there. Sticking with release news, Django Dep 20 has passed, meaning Django is moving to an annual release cycle. Formerly, Django had an 8-month release schedule with a long-term support release every 2 years. That was out of sync with the supported versions of Python, which made things messy. You may recall that Django 6.1 just came out. There will still be a 6.2 in April of next year, with the new year-based version numbering starting in January of 2028. So after that, it will be Django 2028. They're actually using the year as the indicator.
Yeah, okay.
Along with this change, all the versions moving forward will have the same extended support window of 3 years, which means the LTS suffix will basically go away. I personally love this. Django only looked like it used semantic versioning, even though it didn't. I don't think software has to use semantic versioning. I'm fine if it doesn't. But if you're using numbers that look like semantic versioning, Python, I'm looking at you. You're asking for confusion. So I like that confusion has gone away. Oh, that's a little bit of foreshadowing because Python's going to get worse. Anyways, moving on. All right, moving from releases to peps. First off, PEP 8.28, which is named Supporting Yield From in Asynchronous Generators. We've talked about this one before when it was first proposed, and now it's been accepted. The yield from keyword. Keywords? How do you pluralize an atomic thing that is two words? And why do I distract myself mid-sentence and then ramble on out loud, exposing my inner monologue? What was I saying? Oh yeah, three very good questions. Anyhow, yield from allows you to yield the contents of a generator, giving you the ability to yield to something that yields. As the title implies, PEP 8.28 adds this capability to asynchronous generators. Next is PEP 841, titled Adding Frozen Syntax to Optimize Immutable Types. There are two built-in data types that can be frozen, sets and dicts. A frozen set or dict is immutable, meaning it can't be changed. Currently, you create one of these using the frozen set or frozen dict objects. In theory, because they're immutable, they can be optimized. In practice, seeing as Python is a dynamic language, I can shadow the definition of frozen set to mean something else, breaking the ability to be optimized. So the solution proposes a new nomenclature, putting an F in front of the brace brackets used for creating sets or dicts. So that would give you the frozen set or dict. Seeing as this would be part of the language syntax, it couldn't be shadowed, which means the compiler is free to optimize it. I like this idea in theory. In practice, I find the use of the F prefix a weird choice. Oh, you agree. Well,
since we got F strings, right?
We are alone in this, evidently. So teaching that this is something completely different than F strings seems like extra cognitive overhead to me, but evidently there's been a discussion about this already. My preference for using Z for a frozen set is actually explicitly called out in the rejected ideas section. The writers seem to think that F won't be confusing. In fact, there's a long list of rejected prefixes in the rejected ideas section, every last one of which I think is better than F, but, you know, what do I know? The writers even make the leap that an F string technically is immutable, so it's kind of similar. That seems like a stretch to me. I look forward to telling my students, yeah, this is a different thing, but the same thing. But I don't know if we have enough listeners to cause everyone to stampede the discussion groups and loudly exclaim, but this isn't a hill that really is worth dying on. But anyways, I find the choice of F weird.
Because you froze to death on that hill?
I freeze to death on that hill, yes. It's a very tall hill. It's above the snow line.
All right,
one more. PEP 844 is titled Public and Private Built-ins. This is part of a series of PEPs. We talked about the idea of adding a Dunder export in episode 307, a way of explicitly naming what things are visible outside of a module. That was PEP 842, which has since been withdrawn. Something, something, package managers not happy, something, something. So instead, PEP 844 was written before the other one was withdrawn, so this is not like its replacement. And what it's supposed to do is create two new decorators named public and private, which you could use to annotate functions or classes to explicitly make them exported from the module or kept within it. This PEP mentions 842. It also mentions PEP 843, which has an entirely different solution to all this and has the added strangeness of not actually existing yet. Couldn't figure out if 843 was supplanted by 842, which then got removed, or whether 843 is still coming. The confusion about the 2, 3, and 4 notwithstanding, I think I've been sufficiently grumbly about PEPs this week. So if you want my take on this one, copy and paste what I said in 307. More or less boils down to meh.
Yeah, I mean, we have the Dunder naming, but I guess this is moving it to be much more explicit. I guess I need to read these drafts and the hidden 843 draft, wherever it is.
I think I like this idea better than the Dunder export.
Okay.
It feels a little more explicit and in your face. There is actually a third-party library that will do this for you. I assume what it's doing is correctly setting the Dunder all and Dunder export values based on these decorators. Well, without repeating everything I said in 307, I'm not sure this is that important. I got used to this not being in Python, and I'm not sure how important it is, but whatever.
A lot of... I'm wondering where all this energy is coming from. Like, what is the underlying motivations here?
Yeah, these PEPs are by different people. So I don't know whether there was like a big rush around, hey, let's address this problem in the discussion forums. And then a bunch of people came up with PEPs as counter things. And 844, when it calls out 42 and 43, it actually says this is a subtly different problem and it's not saying the others shouldn't exist. So it's kind of an add-on extra thing to go with it. But yeah, I think I've now already said I've spent way more time thinking about this than I need to. So.
Sure. All right. Yeah, I guess Watch This Space, all the stuff that we were talking about in the previous Fight Coders episode is potentially up for debate, and we'll see what's going to happen here. I mean, it's still using a lot of the same techniques. The Thunder All is still going to be there, and this is going to be a mechanism kind of around it. So anyway, well, I guess that takes us into topics, and I'm going to pivot pretty deeply into data science here. My first piece is a new RealPython tutorial. It's by Rohit Goswami, and it's titled Validating Data with Point Blank in Python. I featured an article from Posit recently, and it covered a whole bunch of libraries from Posit, and Point Blank was one of them. If you're not familiar with Posit, they make a whole bunch of tools that are very interesting, and Point Blank is a powerful validation tool, but it has some unique features to it. And what I like about this piece is how it expands on the basics and then showcased kind of what makes this library unique compared to other validation libraries. Fundamentals, it checks a polars or pandas data frame against rules that you declare, and then each rule accumulates failures until you've crossed a threshold that you've set. And then you can decide what you want to do at that point. It can go beyond just polars and pandas type data frames, but it can also validate SQL tables or SQL tables inside of DuckDB or Postgres directly. It can also complement parse time schema tools such as Pydantic rather than replacing them. Pydantic is checking, you know, individual items comparatively to these sort of overall tables or data frames. Rohit starts with installing UV. The examples across this one use UV because of a way that it can run these self-contained scripts. The idea of scripts inside of data science, I think, is something that a lot of developers don't see as much, but that's such a common thing, this way of experimenting and having, you know, rerunnable scripts and having other things here. So we're going to talk a lot about that today, at least across a couple articles that I have. If you haven't explored this side of UV or inline script metadata, then I think this could be another reason for just checking this piece out, because it has some good examples of how that works. So his example uses a built-in data set, which is part of the library. And I'm a fan of this. I think that's great. I think it comes from a lot of these data science libraries where they're like, okay, well, let's include some data here so you can kind of mess around with the tool before you put it into practice on your own data, and allows the ability to create tutorials without a whole lot of rigmarole of trying to find stuff that you can use inside there. So after a quick check in the REPL, making sure that everything is installed, you set up a game plan to check on three columns of the data, and then you set a rule for each one of them. The first one, he explains, is going to be checking an integer column required to be non-null. In this case, two of its rows are null. It checks a numeric column required to fall between a range between 0 and 5,000, and one row is 9,999.99, so it falls outside that range. And then a categorical column that should be limited to having labels of low, mid, and high. And in this particular case, every row already matches that. So you create a script with the inline metadata at the top, and then add those validation steps using the .validate method, which is part of the library. And then you use method chaining, which is a very common thing you'll see with people working with polars or even pandas now, where you'll have .validate and then the parameters for it. And then just below it, dot, in this case, you know, spelled C-O-L, but column values between, and then column vowels in set, and then column values not null. So all these methods are built in for you to be able to try and, you know, set up these parameters here, these rules that you want. At the very end of that chain of these methods, you have one additional method, which is interrogate, which runs all those rules and then collects the results. The end of the script has it print out an F-string formatted table as a report, kind of like a little micro report that you would see inside of the terminal in this case, since you're using it as a command line thing. You get to see which rows passed or failed. And when I spoke about Point Blank a few weeks ago, I mentioned it having a very robust interface for when you run it in a notebook. And it has this HTML report which is also very interactive. It's a really nice tool for data exploration, which I think I maybe mentioned then. And if you're kind of just looking in general for potential issues. The goal of this tutorial is a little different than that. It's designed around the idea of setting thresholds and triggering automated actions to be set up potentially as a continuous integration, choosing if the thing's going to move on. So the next script adds three pieces that would be crucial in this production flow: the thresholds to declare warning, error, and critical cutoffs, which are values you'll set based around percentages there, actions to attach messages to failing steps. So you get to see like, okay, well, what happened in those things that are failing? And then you set a method called assert below threshold to trip continuous integration to have it gate when the data is bad enough that you're like, okay, stop this. The next portion is to route clean and dirty rows. It has a feature that they call data sundering, which I haven't heard that term used in this way, but after the interrogation step, you can collect the data into groups. In his example, he uses two variables, clean equaling validation dot get sundered data type equals pass, and dirty being the reverse of that if it the get sundered data type equals fail. And so now you've collected these separate things. So the question moves beyond if the table passed to like which rows can continue if you want and which rows need review or how much of the batch failed. So at this point, you start to look at ways to integrate this into a repeatable tool to be part of a continuous integration workflow. So then he shows how YAML is a good tool to set up this configuration. You create a few tables in the YAML file with things like the first, you know, table there says point blank underscore atoms.csv, what data frame library is being used, the table name, and then what it should be labeled. There's a threshold table with warning set at 0.02, error at 0.05, and critical at 0.07. And then different steps in there, which are then doing the checks, right? Checking for the values in the set, checking for what values are not null. And it's all formatted in this nice reusable YAML file then that can be imported in. So after showing how that set that up and then run it on this built-in data set, he covers how to make that reusable and configurable as a template, how to set the table to your own CSV path, and then list your real columns under column underscore exists, and then picking the threshold values. At the end of the piece, he has a comparison between these different types of libraries, point blank, Pandera, which you've mentioned before as a validation library, and one I haven't explored too much, which is called Great Expectations. And he looks at like, okay, what are they best for? What are the type of backends they're used against? And then what are some of the trade-offs? I think one of the more unique things about this is that it's data frame and table-based, and it's really designed around that type of flow. And so comparing to Pydantic again, which is, again, looking more at individual record by record validation. So I think point blank might be a useful tool depending on your workflow. Again, I was primarily working with just individual data frames or individual sets of tables of things. And so I can kind of see how this would be helpful. And then I really like this idea of creating reusable tools, which is going to be a theme I'm going to repeat here, and how configuration files can come to the rescue there. So thanks, Rohit. What's your first one here?
My first article this week is by Teva Harsanyi, and it's titled Working on Complex Systems. It's part of his Coder Cafe series, which is available as a newsletter, a set of blog posts, and soon to be a book. We'll link to all that in the show notes. This isn't a Python-specific article, but a software one, and talks about the difference between complicated and complex systems and why you may approach those differently. It's probably best just to quote him directly for the explanation. Complicated problems are intricate but predictable, whereas complex problems are intricate but unique. The first example he gives is filing taxes, which is complicated since they're predictable, if crazy messy, in comparison to climate change mitigation, which is complex. Solutions to complex problems require adaptive approaches. Your first solution likely won't work and will need adjusting. Back to that tax idea, if you were writing software against the tax code, it would probably take a long time to get it all done, and there's a lot of moving pieces, but it's a regimented, tested thing. You just work at it and it'll happen. By contrast, solutions to complex systems tend to be theories. I think this will help mode, which requires a scientific approach of testing, checking, and then revising. They also are sometimes counterintuitive, or at least common sense doesn't necessarily get you closer to a solution. The article outlines some characteristics of complex systems, starting with emergent behavior. This arises when the overall behavior within a system can't be predicted based solely on its individual parts. The whole is more than the sum. A lot of AI systems are emergent. We often can't figure out how an LLM arrived at the solution that it did. The solution might be correct, we just don't understand how it got there. Another characteristic of complex systems is delayed consequences. This is sort of self-evident. Actions may not have an immediate effect. Of course, that makes it harder to determine cause and effect, which makes it harder to adjust your approach. Once again, quoting directly, relying solely on immediate feedback can create a false sense of stability. The next characteristic comes out of the definition, where the sum of the parts might be different from the whole. A consequence of that is optimizing or changing one part might not affect the whole, or might not affect it the same way as the part. Making one part faster might not make the whole thing faster. The last two characteristics kind of go together. Hysteresis is a fancy word for the fact that an effect can continue to happen after the cause has been removed. The example he gives is traffic. Clearing the accident doesn't actually immediately make the traffic flow faster. Somewhat connected to that is the last one, non-linearity. Small changes can have disproportionately large or unpredictable effects. My hometown of Toronto was one of the hosts of the World Cup this year. One of the stats that came out afterwards was that we had about 20% more congestion during the event. Having been in some of those traffic jams, I can tell you that that 20% increase in congestion did not result in a 20% increase in the amount of time it took to get home. It was far worse than that. That's about half the article. Now that you understand the properties of complex systems, the second half goes on to describe some patterns that can help you when you encounter such beasts in the wild. Teva has some great stuff here. His book, which includes this article along with many others, is in early release and can be purchased through Manning Now. Both it and his articles are definitely worth your time. One of the benefits of being a Manning author myself is I know their marketing people, and those very same people have been kind enough to extend a discount code to our listeners. Use CoderCafe40 at checkout to get 40% off both the digital and DeadTree versions until November 21st. So good stuff here.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. Do you want to send emails with Python? Automate confirmation messages, password resets, or scheduled notifications. Python's standard library covers the whole pipeline from making a server connection to building the message and sending it to one or many recipients. This video course is titled Sending Emails Using Python. It's based on a tutorial by John Fincher, and in the video course, your instructor is my co-host, Christopher Trudeau. Through the course, you'll learn the basics of sending an email in Python and how to create a safe testing setup using a throwaway Gmail account, use a local debug server, or use a privacy-focused provider like Postio or ProtonMail, how to send using a secure SMTP session that validates the server certificate and encrypts your credentials and message content, and then how to use the email message class to create plain text HTML alternatives, file attachments, and personalized fields. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. And like most of the recent courses on Real Python, there are exercises woven through your path along the course to test your knowledge. Check out the video course. You can find the link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Okay, so continuing on my theme here of data science stuff, this one is from Quinn Tron at CodeCut. And I think it must be, I think it might have been refeatured as the original date is from 2025 or maybe earlier. It expands on the conversation that I had with her on the show in episode 274. She spoke frequently on how to improve working in data science all about sort of the developer experience, but toward the unique scenarios of data science. So when you're working on data, you often have a whole set of different goals from a typical developer. It's way more common that you're going to be using a program repeatedly with different data or modifying it to run a new experiment. And what that means is you will want to prepare it in a formulaic way. I think it's one of the many reasons that data scientists like functional programming. Just a quick Wikipedia definition. Functional programming is a programming paradigm where programs are constructed by applying and composing functions. It is a declarative programming paradigm in which function definitions are trees of expressions that map values to other values rather than a sequence of imperative statements, which update the running state of the program. And I've discussed this a lot lately, talking about the idea of SQL being much more declarative than imperative in what you're, you know, how you're writing it. It mostly consists of functions trying to avoid the side effects. And Python can do this, right? But you have to sort of prepare and think a little differently. Python's very, very flexible on how you want to work inside of it. So I just want to keep that in mind as you think about this piece. The piece is titled Hydra for Python Configuration, Build Modular and Maintainable Pipelines. I like that it builds on the previous piece in this whole idea of data pipelines and building reusable configurations. She starts, though, with this whole idea of like, well, why should you avoid hard coding things? And there's three problems caused by hard coding parameters into your scripts. One is the maintainability of it. Manually updating the same parameter across different files or functions is tedious and can be quite error prone. Reusability, hard coding values limits the reusability of code for other scenarios. And then security, which we've seen a lot in this age of AI stuff, or even before that, of like hard coding secrets like API keys and passwords or database URLs directly into scripts can be a real serious risk. And then there are other advantages: cleaner code and easier maintenance, keeping configuration separate from logic makes scripts easier to read and maintain. Faster experimentations. They allow you to tweak parameters like features and splits of testing data and then adjusting hyperparameters without modifying the source code. And then a simplified deployment with config files adapting to different environments like development or testing or production. It can be a little more straightforward as far as like how that looks in deployment. So the article follows Quinn's style of having code examples below each one of these concepts that she's trying to get across, either it be a feature or function that she's showing off there. Really good naming of the variables and functions to further explain what's happening. And this is where this tool, Hydra, comes in. She shows its installation. After that, she gets into the structure way to organize the configuration files of having a CONF or configuration folder, if you will, that will include the YAML files. And then at the same level of the configuration directory, there'll also be a source directory, an SRC folder right there with your Python scripts. You go through this process of setting up a YAML file with the parameters that you want to apply. In this case, it's things like, well, which columns would you want to drop? What is the test size? What are the hyperparameters? Where the data lives? And which models? In the case of using Hydra, you use a decorator on your main function in your script, at Hydra, and it has parameters for where to find that particular configuration file, which would be the thing you'd be updating in that case. So she digs into ways to override the parameters. If you're experimenting, you can configure it to work with the command line and shows how you can have it print out with your results how the parameters were adjusted. So you can kind of see in your audit trail what's been happening. She shares another strategy if you're looking for more flexibility. Hydra allows you to group configuration files. So you can organize related configuration into these separate groups. So you can manage variations of like, okay, well, how should pre-processing work? And what models do I want to do? And what are the training strategies in this sort of modular way? It's a neat library, and she digs much deeper into that. I don't want to get into more of the details here, but it uses these special dictionaries and dot notation. So it actually is pretty elegant as far as like how you write the code to implement these configurations. It's a good demonstration for a way to establish this flexible, repeatable system. And avoid that hard coding parameters in your data science scripts. So thanks, Quinn. All right, what do you got next here?
My next article is by James Bennett, and it's titled Breaking Up Lines is Hard to Do. The lines part is in brackets to highlight his abuse of the cliche. The article is actually about Python's split lines method on the string type. As you might be aware, what split lines does is split a string up into pieces based on the lines in the text. If, like me, you occasionally still use split on slash n instead, you should break that habit, and this article more or less explains why. As with most things with text, simple often isn't that simple. In olden times, there was just ASCII. Yeah, there were a couple others out there, but for the longest time, ASCII won that particular battle, regardless of how hard IBM tried to make it otherwise. ASCII is pretty simple and was designed based on teletype machines. Think printers directly hooked up to a computer, because screens didn't really exist yet. ASCII includes two characters for causing you to go to the next line: line feed, which advanced the paper up by a row in the teletype machine, and carriage return, which returned the print head to the beginning of the line. These two concepts are covered by slash R and slash N, or at least they were originally. The history of computing is messy, though, and as teletypes were replaced by screens, most systems started to use the single slash N character to mean both carriage return and line feed. Or more accurately, the carriage return character caused the down row and to the left action in a single byte. This is why on some computing systems, slash n is represented as a single character, and in others, it's represented as two bytes. Python is aware of this, so if you split on slash n, it knows which representation your computer uses and adjusts accordingly. This is also why, occasionally, when you read text files in that were written by somebody on another computer, you either don't have the line returns or you get weird extra characters in your lines. So, unless, of course, you wrote a Python script, because it tries to do that for you. The title of the next section in the article actually says it all. Then Unicode happened. So ASCII is based on the Western Latin alphabet, and even if you're staying in that alphabet, it can be problematic if you're not using English. ASCII got extended to include accented characters, but that's still a rounding error in the size of the list of characters used throughout the world. Unicode was designed to solve this problem, and version 18, which is the most recent, currently has almost 300,000 symbols in it. And note my switch from the word character to symbol, because, well, like I said, complicated. By the way, about a third of those are for Han Chinese, in case you're curious, and there are another 500,000 or so code points which have been reserved for future use, so it's a very big standard. So I also glossed over some of the ASCII problem, as there are other symbols in it which can cause end line indications, like form feed and vertical tab characters. But as I was getting on my Unicode makes this more complicated, Unicode adds a line separator and a paragraph separator. And these are kind of make sense because they are there to distinguish between soft line breaks, like line wraps, and hard line breaks for things like the end of a paragraph. And if that's not bad enough, there are three more characters that make life even worse, those which can change the directional flow of text. Not all languages are written from left to right. Some are left to right, but some are right to left. And this isn't a property of the whole text, but within the text. A string could be written in Spanish, which quotes something in Arabic, and those are two different systems. There are even older writing systems that use a Boustrophedon style, which means each line switches direction. That might seem weird to us, but it's kind of more efficient on the eyes. Your eyes are already on the right side of the page, so why make them carriage return line feed when you can just line feed and read in the other direction?
Just snake on down to page.
Exactly. So I've skipped over some of the particulars, but all in all, to properly split lines in a string, you need to account for 10 different code points and one multi-code point sequence. Thankfully, Python does this for you, and you can take advantage of it simply by using split lines like you should. Thanks to James for writing a detailed article explaining all of this and how we got here. I think every time I touch Unicode, it's worse than I thought it was. And I already knew it was a mess. So,
worse or vast.
Well, yeah, worse is not fair. It's a decent standard. I'm not implying otherwise. It's just, right. As a little bit of a callback, the line between complicated and complex is being skated by the Unicode standard. So, yeah.
So it has the 10 different code points in it. The split lines has. Okay, yeah. So you don't have to just look for slash N.
And this is why you should use split lines, because if you do slash N, you're not going to cover the redirection piece. You're not going to cover... So Python's smart enough that if you're on a system that uses slash N slash R for slash N,
it's fine.
It will do that.
Yeah.
But it only does that, and it doesn't cover the other 9 situations. So
Yeah. Should use the right tool. All right. Well, that takes us into projects. And continuing my theme of data science stuff, I got a couple Marimo things. And Marimo Book is my first one, which is a static site generator for Marimo notebooks. It's from Luke Chang. The project is in alpha, but Luke has been using it for a few of his own projects, which I think is cool. I'll take a look at that in just a moment. But it's a Jupyter Book style static site generator. So that's another tool that's out there. But it's built specifically for Marimo.py notebooks. Marimo saves stuff in a .py file, if you're not familiar, just a pure Python file, which is nice. It produces a polished multi-page site, and it includes a lot of the features of Marimo, such as any widgets. That's a library that's available there that can then be rendered statically. You can have interactive canvas or 3JS or Plotly widgets without a Marimo kernel. So it can be, again, on a static page. Static reactivity for discrete sliders. They can be pre-rendered using lookup tables, so no kernel is required there. You can set explicit steps for them. There's a WASM render mode per chapter, PyAdide-driven full reactivity for chapters that need it, and then uses the MKDocs theming material for MKDocs. So you have full text search, dark mode, code copy, breadcrumbs, responsive layout. There is a marimo-book.org site to see an example site that works as documentation also, which is nice. It shows off a bunch of the interactivity in the pre-rendering, so you can get an idea of what that looks like and feels like. For another example, Luke has a site for an online course that's called Dart Brains. And from the intro, how can we understand how the brain works? This course provides an introduction into in vivo neuroimaging in humans using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. The goal of the class is to introduce how the scanner generates data, how physiological states can be probed in the scanner, and then how data can be processed and analyzed. Students will be expected to analyze brain imaging data using the open source Python programming language. I did a short inspection through the whole course, and it looks like a really nice resource. If you're looking for a practical data science course to play around with data and learn a little bit about how fMRI works, it uses the interactive widgets. They're all peppered through it, showing off how magnetic resonance imaging works. I think it's really cool that Luke did this. I think it's also sort of a way of scratching your own itch using some tools out there. The contributor, along with himself, is Claude in this case. I think it's a really good resource for multiple reasons. A way for you to take your Marimo notebooks and turn them into a static site if you'd like, but also a tool if you're wanting to dig into a little bit of a data science course and learn a little bit about fMRI, another resource. And then the other short mention I have is from the Marimo team themselves. They've made a language server and VS Code extension for Marimo. So if you're a VS Code user and would like to use Marimo in it, here you go. I'll include a link for Marimo-LSP on GitHub. And then there's also a link that I'll provide that is for the extension directly in the Visual Studio Marketplace. All right, what do you got next?
I've got something by Artem Golubin, who goes by Rushter on GitHub. The tool is called Hexora and does security linting. It uses static analysis to detect malicious patterns in Python, and it has both a rule-based mechanism as well as a machine learning model that scores your code and highlights potential problems. You essentially use this to audit your code or maybe a PR submission for your repo or analyze an update to a third-party package that you're thinking of using if you want to figure out whether or not there's anything untoward inside. Hexora lets you audit a single file, a directory, or a package installed in a virtual environment. And similar to other linting tools, the rules have IDs, so you can use the exclude flag if there are certain things that you want to ignore. Since this is Python, you can also import this as a library and call the audit methods with a script if you want, which makes hooking it into a CI/CD pipeline easier if you need to do some customization. Hexora currently has about 40 rules that come with it, and the documentation says more are being added. Some sample rules are things like the code is accessing browser data like cookies or history, code is using exec or calling out to the shell, it's accessing the clipboard, importing a pickled object, downloading binary data, and loads more. So if you're worried about the security of the code you're using, Hexora is something you might use to help you get a better handle on it.
Nice. Lots of great tools. All right. Well, thanks for bringing all these articles and news and projects this week, Christopher.
Yeah, happy to be here. See you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Talk to you soon. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.